Yahweh News.
Ukrainian officials say they see no signs of Russian forces backing away from the capital of Kyiv.
The situation is changing quite often. The thing is that Ukrainian forces really pushed them away, but Russian forces do not stop trying to push back.
Plus, Ukrainian and Russian delegations are scheduled to arrive in Turkey for another round of peace talks. It's the first time the two sides have met face-to-face in more than 2 weeks.
It's not going to be easy to resolve this situation.
And later in the program, the impact the war is having on wheat. Today is Monday, March 28th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. On the ground throughout Ukraine, there was no sign of respite for civilians in besieged cities as attacks by Russian forces continued. In the port city of Mariupol, the mayor says people were still trapped inside and that Russia was blocking attempts to evacuate them. The Kremlin also said it was alarmed by comments made by U.S. President Joe Biden at the close of his speech on Saturday night.
For God's sake, this man cannot remain power.
However, the White House almost immediately walked back the president's remarks, saying that it was not looking for regime change in Russia, something that the president himself affirmed on Sunday in an exchange with reporters.
Mr. President, do you want Putin removed? Mr. President, were you calling for regime change?
No. For an update on what's taking place on the ground, I spoke with reporter Anna Chernikova in Western Ukraine. I began our conversation by asking her for an update on the situation around the capital of Kyiv, where officials say that they see no signs of Russian forces pulling back.
The situation is changing quite often. The thing is that Ukrainian forces really pushed them away at certain points to 35 kilometers away, at certain points at 70 kilometers away. But Russian forces do not stop trying to push back. So basically the fightings are going on. And just 5 minutes ago, it was an update that the city of Irpin was cleared from Russian forces. And officials said that the next two cities that which are planned to be cleared are Vorzel and Bucha. But again, officials are highlighting that it's still not, obviously not safe to come back to the cities, and still they are waiting for another attack.
And I also wanted to ask you about what's been taking place in your area, because there have been reports of additional Russian strikes near Lviv that destroyed a fuel depot of sorts. What can you tell us about the fighting in Western Ukraine?
Yeah, this is true. City near Lviv, and Lviv itself was attacked. Russian forces are attacking oil storages, so reservoirs. So what they're trying to do is to create humanitarian disaster, because obviously everyone needs oil to, you know, a country needs oil to operate. Also, food storages are attacked. So it's oil and food storages which are targeted right now.
And I also want to ask you about Mariupol, because, again, that is a city that has been besieged. The fighting continues around it. What can you tell us about the latest updates on that port city?
Yeah, unfortunately, the city of Mariupol remains in the catastrophic condition. So, the fightings are going on. Ukrainian army are fighting back from the city, inside the city. So it remains under Ukrainian control, but it remains just an unbelievable attack by the Russian forces. So now we can definitely say that the fighting for Mariupol is one of the, you know, the most important in that part of the country. Unfortunately, more than, so according to the, again, to the latest numbers of today, more than 160,000 people of the civilians remain in Mariupol. And there is no possibility to get any humanitarian aid in. And in general, today, all humanitarian corridors were canceled because Russian forces said that they're not going to guarantee any security for those corridors. So yes, the city of Mariupol probably, well, it just remains, you know, the most difficult part of this war at the moment. The most difficult situation in the city it remains, and poor civilians still suffering.
Anna Chernikova is reporting for us from Western Ukraine. Thank you very much, and please stay safe.
Yeah, thank you.
The leading independent Russian newspaper, Novaya Gazeta, which is edited by Nobel Peace Prize winner Dmitry Muratov, says that it is suspending operations after receiving warnings from Russian authorities. Russia strictly limits how media can describe the events in Ukraine, which it labels a special military operation. The newspaper reported being warned by the state communications regulator. Several other Russian media outlets have already opted for suspending operations rather than face heavy restrictions on what they can report. And the Kremlin has also blocked multiple foreign news outlets. Speaking at the United Nations on Monday, UN Secretary General Antony Guterres announced a new effort to help those in need.
I'm therefore appealing for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire to allow for progress in serious political negotiations aiming at reaching a peace agreement based on the principles of the United Nations Charter.
Guterres reiterated that the fighting in Ukraine must stop. In Turkey, Ukrainian and Russian officials are scheduled to arrive on Monday for what is shaping up to be the first face-to-face peace talks in more than 2 weeks. For more of the talks, I spoke with VOA's Dorian Jones in Istanbul and began our conversation by asking him, what do we know about the forthcoming discussions?
Well, to be honest, very little. And I think one of the factors behind that is it does appear to be quite last minute. The fact that Istanbul was become the host of these talks apparently was only agreed after Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan spoke with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, over the weekend. And then there was an announcement saying that come Monday that there will be the start of talks which will last 3 days. Very little details, even where it's going to be held in Istanbul. No one knows. And I think that does suggest that they are in a scramble, as it were, to set everything up for these very important talks. The Ukrainian delegation was saying that they expected talks to start Monday, but the Russian delegation appeared to have rejected that, saying that, in fact, the talks will be Tuesday. So even when these two delegations will sit down and face one another is far from clear, although it does appear Tuesday will be the time when these two will meet. Before that, it is expected that Turkey will be holding talks with the individual delegations on their own as well. But as of yet, it really there isn't that much detail about how the structure of these talks will be held, what will be the content of them. But it is seen as significant that these talks are now being held in Turkey as opposed to the previous ones of Belarus. Belarus is seen as a very close ally to Russia, and the Ukrainians were very unhappy about having these talks, whereas Turkey is seen as a country that has good relations with both sides. Russian Turkish president has good ties with Vladimir Putin, but also with the Ukrainian president Volodymyr Zelensky. So Turkey is seen as a very much an even-handed host for these talks, which is seen as significant.
Well, can you tell us more about the position on each side? Because the Ukrainians have once more said that they're really focusing on security guarantees as well as territorial integrity. And one of the officials in the so-called Luhansk Republic has said that they plan on holding a referendum shortly to vote on whether or not they should join Russia. So what can you tell us about both sides in terms of their positions? Because in past talks, there have been quite a divergent view.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not going to be easy to resolve this situation. As you said, yeah, I mean, a key stumbling block in these talks is seeing the status of these breakaway republics of Donbass and Luhansk, and also Crimea, which was annexed by Russia, but that annexation was not accepted by the international community. the status of these areas are seen as critical. The Ukrainian president has been very clear, saying that he's not going to give up the territorial integrity of his country in any shape or form. So how this area is going to be resolved is seen as one of the key points that creating some possible common ground. A possible idea that's been floated is that possibly these areas could be leased from Ukraine by Russia. That was what happened with China and the United Kingdom way back in the 19th century with Hong Kong. That is seen as a possible idea, but at the moment, it does seem to be very little common ground here, and I think that's a major point of contention. Russia's calls for Ukrainian's neutrality, that's seen as there is a possible solution there. In fact, the Ukrainian president even indicated they were prepared to explore that on the basis that they had international security guarantees. So there is possible progress there, but it's the status of these breakaway republics, which I think is key. And I don't think anyone's expecting a major breakthrough in these talks. It's part of a long process where they can try to find some common ground, and then that will lay the basis for this meeting between the Ukrainian and Russian presidents.
And Dorian, I wanted to ask you about Turkey itself. Recep Tayyip Erdogan, as you mentioned, has been trying to position Turkey as a go-between, as a country trying to maintain good relations with both Russia and Ukraine. But it has also been paying a very steep price throughout this process. What do we know about what Turkey hopes to achieve by hosting this?
Well, and this is, I mean, seen as a very much a diplomatic victory for Turkey. I mean, at the onset of this conflict, Turkey was always trying to position itself as, if not a mediator, a facilitator. And to be honest, most of its allies boastedly dismissed this idea. But Turkey had stayed in the game. It has worked very hard. Early this month, it did host a meeting between the Ukrainian and Russian foreign ministers here in Turkey. It didn't come to anything, but it does seem to be a part of an ongoing process where this latest meeting in Istanbul is part of that. And President Erdogan has been working very hard behind the scenes because he's paying a very high price. Turkey's economy is being devastated by the fallout of this conflict. Turkey imports most of its wheat from Ukraine and Russia, as well as crucial raw materials, energy, and also its tourism sector depends very heavily on Russian and Ukrainian tourists. So Turkey's a major loser here, and already the economy is in a really bad situation, and Erdogan is facing re-election next year. But the fact that he is hosting these talks and he is working hard for this has also increased his international reputation. In many ways, he's been under a lot of criticism from his Western allies over his close ties with Putin. But now Erdogan is looking to his close Western allies and saying, see, having a relationship with someone like Putin can be useful for everyone. And in the NATO summit last week, very much Erdogan was embraced by his fellow NATO partners, something we haven't seen for a very long time. And that is seen as a sign of Erdogan's rising stock and seen as his importance in possibly resolving this conflict.
Dorian Jones is reporting for VOA from Istanbul, Turkey. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. VOA national correspondent Steve Herman continues our coverage of the war's impact on food insecurity.
What does the price of chapatis in Bangladesh have to do with the war in Ukraine? A lot, it turns out. One person who can help explain it is Vince Peterson, the president of U.S. Wheat Associates, which is the export development organization in the United States for that important crop. Vince, chapatis, also called rotis, made from wheat flour, are a staple food in the Indian subcontinent, and the price is skyrocketing. And people in Uganda are paying more for one of their favorite meals, kikamando, which is composed of chapati and beans. So what does this all have to do, Vince, with the war in Ukraine?
You know, it starts out with a very basic premise. When we went into this season's wheat crop globally, we had just experienced three or four consecutive years where the world was consuming more wheat than producing each of those three or four years. And we started out with a beginning supply of wheat in the exportable countries around the world. And that exportable supply is about 200 million tons that moves around, with the lowest relative stocks to the global use that we've had on record. And prices were rising anyway through the last 12 months. And then we came to the invasion of Russia into Ukraine. Those two countries alone account for about 30% of that 200 million ton trade pie of world wheat movement. And when the war came in and those ports essentially were shut off, that essentially took a supply chain hit of about 30% of the world's supply out of the market, at least until we see how that digests itself. That's a big hit, and we've seen prices just skyrocket as a result.
Markets are all about supply and demand, and we learned that in Economics 101 class. So when it comes to wheat worldwide, and with planting disrupted in Ukraine, and as you talked about, the exports from Russia somewhat being restricted by Moscow, not welcome due to sanctions or other factors, where else can countries buy sufficient wheat?
The United States is, for years, was the world's largest export supplier of wheat. That changed about a half a dozen to 10 years ago, and frankly, we were surpassed by Russia in terms of their exportable supplies. But the U.S. does carry over stocks. We have stocks at our disposal, but they are not unlimited. But there are others around. Australia's had two record crops in a row, and they certainly are very busy right now filling those voids. And even some unorthodox ones, and I put it in terms of non-traditional exporters, a country like India that had a couple of back-to-back bumper crops and very highly subsidized domestically. Normally, they're not exporters, but there's probably 6 or 8 million tons of wheat in India that now is being marketed into the world market. The market's very resilient to these things, and I think the world will survive this, although price is going to be high for everybody in the process.
How flexible are farmers to change their crops? Because I believe there's different types of wheat, whether you're going to end up making bread or noodles, and different markets have different preferences.
Yes, they do. And the big difference on these two things will be the timing of the planting of the crop. So in terms of decision-making for U.S. and North American farmers, that spring wheat crop potentially could have some additional planting because of the profitability of wheat compared to corn, soybean, and some other things. It's a little better this year, perhaps, than others. Same would be true then when you reverse to the southern hemisphere as they start planting this spring for what would be our wintertime harvest, in their case, November, December.
Finally, Vince, if this war were to go on for months or expand, how concerned are you about long-term disruptions to the wheat market?
I'm quite concerned about it. I mean, particularly with Ukraine, which is almost exclusively out of the ability to export anything. They're making some efforts to try to get some of their commodities down through Moldova and Romania and some of those contiguous countries to the west. The Russian situation is somewhat questionable. There are sanctions in place on Western banks, but there are a whole bunch of other ones that are not sanctioned. So payments into Turkish banks or Middle Eastern banks or Indian subcontinent banks or Chinese banks, those aren't sanctioned. So there is still exports going on from Russia that will moderate a little bit of these things. But the world has a big hole to fill.
That's the word on wheat from Vince Peterson, president of U.S. Wheat Associates.
Steve Herman is VOA's national correspondent. Relatives of Nigerian students trapped in the Ukrainian Black Sea port city of Kherson are calling on authorities to do more to return them safely home. Over the past few weeks, some of the estimated 80 students trapped in Kherson have tried to reach safety in neighboring countries, but not everyone got lucky. Timothy Abizu has more.
Lizzie Ogaji searches through her phone for an update on the war in Ukraine, hoping for positive news, but finding little to lift her hopes. Her brothers trapped in Kherson, a Ukrainian city occupied by invading Russian forces. She says he tried to escape the war-torn city this week, but was turned around by the Russian military.
I am worried, like seriously worried, because each time I turn to the television, turn to the channel, listen to the scene, the headlines and the news. In short, my heart aches.
Kherson fell to Russian forces in early March, days after the invasion started, trapping hundreds of international students like Ogaji's brother in the city. For weeks, they have been living in extremely cold bomb shelters with limited access to food, medicines, and the internet. Nigerian authorities have promised to evacuate the students, but say that can only happen with a ceasefire in place. Many students have been making individual escape attempts. Jerry Kenny, who mobilized a pack of foreign nationals trapped in Kherson, just made it out.
We ran out of food, water, and I was out of cash.
Some of the students escaping Kherson have received aid from non-profit groups trying to evacuate foreign nationals from the city. Danielle Onyekwere from U.S.-based Diaspora Relief says the evacuations are risky and expensive.
Right now, we're not going off of any safe corridor. There is no humanitarian corridor as of this time. What we're going off with is just routes that we know locals have taken that they made it. So it's still a risk on its own, but it's just like, why not try then, you know, still stay stranded there while we're waiting on negotiations, especially if things are getting worse.
For now, Ogaji's brother remains stuck in Ukraine, but she says her daily communication with him gives her family hope.
He never gave or feel, he never showed any negative feelings of the situation in Ukraine. So he only always encouraged me. He would say, don't worry, sis, I will be fine.
No one knows if a ceasefire will be agreed upon anytime soon. For now, an escape attempt might be his only chance to leave Kherson. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Images of Olena Kirilo's bloody face have become a symbol of Russia's attack in Ukraine and its civilians. They impressed the Los Angeles-based artist Zhenya Gershman so much that she painted a portrait of Kirilo from a photograph. Anna Rice narrates this story to round us out.
For artist Zhenya Gershman, granddaughter of Soviet poet Mikhail Mutusovsky, Russia's attack on Ukraine came as a shock. Her grandfather, who had moved to California from Moscow many years ago, would not have survived the trauma, she says.
He loved culture, he loved the Russian language, but his roots were in Ukraine. His father, my great-grandfather, was the first photographer in Luhansk. He would not have survived this war, he would have simply gotten a heart attack.
For years, Gershman has been pouring her soul onto canvas. These latest events were not an exception. After she saw this photograph of Ukrainian Alena Kurila, she knew what she had to do.
These eyes talk to me. I just had to do something.
After she was done, she showed the portrait to a friend, filmmaker Adrian Roop.
I couldn't look away. I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I wrote back to her immediately saying this is something that could launch a movement.
Adrian helped me get in touch with an auction, with the largest art auction house in the world, Heritage Auctions. They have millions of active participants. And they hope that in the 2 weeks that the auction for this painting will last, they can raise millions that will all go to the Red Cross Foundation to help Ukraine.
Gershman is in touch with the photographer who made the photograph of Kurila. Wolfgang Schwan is American. He flew to Ukraine to document everything that was going on there. On the very first day, Kurila got caught on his camera.
On the way, we noticed a large plume of smoke coming from the direction of Chugoyev. We made the decision that we're going to head to that area, see what it is that's burning. And so we just accidentally arrived at a civilian complex that had been struck. We parked the car in between these two buildings. The first person that we see is actually Olena.
The photograph made many newspapers' front pages around the world. In Russia, the picture was called a fake, and the woman on it, an actress wearing makeup. Kurila is a teacher from the village of Chuhuev. When the shelling started early on February 24th, she was inside her apartment. She says it's a miracle she is still alive.
Suddenly, there was a loud bang and shattered glass falling on me. Blood was pouring onto my face. When I managed to leave the building, I saw three reporters. I didn't pay attention to them. They were taking pictures.
Kurila was surprised her bloodied face became the symbol of Russia's aggression in Ukraine. She was also surprised to learn how many people wanted to help her.
We're helping her find a surgeon. She can't see with one eye. She needs urgent surgery, but there are no surgeons who can help during the war. We sent her some financial aid. She has nowhere to live. She has nothing.
Gershman continues to work. She bases a lot of her portraits on Schwan's photographs. After Russia's invasion comes to an end, She hopes to organize an exhibition together with Schwann. For Angelina Bogdasaryan in Los Angeles, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with continuing coverage, not only on Ukraine, but news and events from around the world 24 hours a day. You can do so at voanews.com and on our social media platforms. Just be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.